Transmitiendo desde San Ildefonso número 28, antigua escuela de jurisprudencia, grado 0 en la enseñanza del derecho en México, esto es Procrastinando, un programa de filosofía del derecho con un carácter totalmente informal.
Good afternoon, buenas tardes, Facultad de Derecho, buenas tardes, Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, buenas tardes, México, buenos días en donde sean buenos días y buenas noches en donde sean buenas noches. Hoy tenemos un gran invitado y un gran placer de poder platicar con tal vez uno de los más importantes teóricos del derecho contemporáneo, como es el doctor Will Baluchau, que hoy se encuentra aquí en el Instituto de Investigaciones Jurídicas y que gracias al apoyo del doctor Imer y del doctor Juan Vega podemos platicar. Good afternoon, profesor Baluchau.
Good afternoon.
This program is about get to the students the main ideas from the major theories of law. And I would like to start this interview with one basic question. In your first book or your thesis, inclusive legal positivism, you talk about in the introduction that you got advice from Hart, which was your tutor, and about with Ronald Dworkin. How was the relation? Because you say that Ronald Dworkin was, he didn't agree with much of your ideas.
That's correct. I was Hart student, and I was fundamentally in favor of the theory that Hart put forward, and Dworkin as the premier or most influential critic of Hart was a person I needed to address. And my doctoral thesis, and then later the book, Inclusive Legal Positivism, which arose or developed out of that thesis and papers that were published subsequently that themselves arose out of that doctoral thesis. In that work, I defended Hart's general theory of law against Dworkin's objections, and I was very fortunate when I was a student, because at the time, not only was Hart present in Oxford, and not only was he willing to supervise my doctoral dissertation, Ronald Dworkin was there. He was Hart's successor in the chair of jurisprudence, and so I had the opportunity to talk to him as well, So on a couple of occasions, I met with Dworkin and to discuss the ideas that I was putting forward in my thesis. And although he disagreed with virtually everything I had to say, he was very gracious in acknowledging that what I was doing was worthwhile, and was very encouraging. So I benefited from exposure to both great, great men, and I consider myself very fortunate in the situation I found myself.
In your work in the inclusive legal positivism, I don't know if the right translation, but in the work in Spanish, they talk about moral politica, I guess it's
political morality.
Political morality. Yes. What is the difference? Because when someone read it, it seems that when you talk about political morality, is the same as legitimacy in the political sense.
It's a morality dealing with the political organs of society. So it's a morality that should govern the way government bodies operate. It's a morality that concerns the relationship between government and citizens. And this is distinguished from, say, morality at the personal level, where we're talking about interpersonal relationships, say, between you and me, whether I should keep my promise to you that I made and so on. That's a little different from political morality, which concerns the moral relations among government bodies and government bodies and individuals. So it's that kind of morality that is the morality that law tends to deal with, at least in the kinds of cases that Dworkin and Hart were arguing about.
As you were a student of Hart, also were Joseph Ras, what are the main differences with all major theorists know about your work in between Ras' work, Dworkin's work, and Hart's work? Because there are small differences in what...
Ras, Dworkin, and Hart?
And your work.
And my work. Well, at the level of general legal theory, which is the level at which those people were in competition with each other, the views that I've defended in the book in particular are more in line with Hart's, although there are certain Razian themes that find expression there as well. Ras being a proponent of what I call exclusive legal positivism is different from the view that I articulate. Dworkin, on the other hand, has a slightly different view about how morality can enter into law than, say, the Hartian view, and then Ras's view is entirely different as well. So I'm more in line with Hart, with tinges of Ras, and as my latest work, including this paper I gave today, indicates, I'm finding more affinity, more and more affinity with some of Dworkin's themes as well. So, my views are a combination of all three.
In the second major work you make, The Living Tree, there's a chapter where you talk about the democratic tension that is equal to rights. Or to law. In the book in Spanish, they said, la tensión democrática es igual a los derechos, o genera derechos. What do you understand with democratic tension?
Well, the democratic tension is what I talked about in my paper today. First of all, I should say that the book you're referring to, The Living Tree book, is an attempt by me to defend judicial review of principally legislation created by democratically accountable bodies like Parliament or Congress, and judicial review has judges interfering with the legislative efforts of those democratically responsible bodies, and it appears as if, this is what the critics say, that judicial review is fundamentally at odds with democratic principle, which requires that the decisions made by democratically accountable bodies like Parliament or Congress should prevail within a democratic society. And judges, on the other hand, are typically unelected, they're appointed, they don't represent the community in the way that the legislature does, and yet these individuals are telling the legislature that their laws are invalid constitutionally. This seems undemocratic to people. So there's a tension there between judicial review and the commitments to democracy. What I attempt to do in my book is to develop a view about what judges are doing when they engage in judicial review under a charter, what I call charter review, that renders that practice consistent with democratic principles, because on the view that I defend, what the judges are doing when they strike down a piece of legislation that's been passed by Parliament or Congress on grounds of some constitutional right violation, what they are in effect doing is enforcing the democratic community's own more fundamental commitments, and showing in the act of judicial review that the law that's been enacted by the legislature is in fact inconsistent with those fundamental commitments, and therefore the judge is in effect, when he does that, rendering the democratic will more effective by allowing the more fundamental commitments to be honored, and this more transient preference on the part of the democratic community is set to the side in favor of these more fundamental commitments. So the judge is actually in effect doing a service for the democratic community by enforcing its more fundamental commitments. So this is a way of trying to reconcile judicial review with the fundamental vision we have of what democracy is all about.
You use two concepts that are quite interesting, and I would like to get the definition you use in this. One is a strong constitutionalism, and the other one is
strong judicial review.
Yes, in the book in Spanish they put it that constitucionalismo fuerte, mm-hmm. and the other one is constitutional democracy.
Okay, all right. Well, let's begin with the latter, the constitutional democracy. constitutional democracy is a phrase that's usually used to contrast with a system of parliamentary supremacy, such as was arguably the case in the United Kingdom for a significant period of time. And the fundamental premise of that particular view and that particular practice, that particular political arrangement, is that Parliament is supreme. That whatever Parliament decides to enact, that's valid law, and it has legitimacy as an expression of the democratic will. There are no limits to what the legislature can enact. Constitutional democracy, on the other hand, is a view according to which there are limits on what the democratic legislature can do, and these limits are expressed typically in charters or bills of rights. And so, what judicial review does is enforce those commitments against the democratic decisions of democratic bodies, but it's rendered, as I said a moment ago, democratic by the fact that the commitments are a function of the community's own commitments to these constitutional principles. So anyway, that's the fundamental difference between a parliamentary supremacy system and a system of constitutional democracy, where the constitutional limits are placed upon the legislature's ability to legislate. What was the other one you asked about?
The strong constitutionalism.
Oh, strong constitutionalism. Okay, what I had in mind there is what is usually referred to as strong or strong-form judicial review. And this is the view, this is the form of judicial review that's practiced in the United States. And it's the fundamental feature of this particular form of review is that the judge's decisions are final. So if the Supreme Court rules that Congress has violated the Constitution and that their legislation is therefore constitutionally invalid, it's constitutionally invalid. That is now becoming a less attractive option around the world. Many systems, Canada included, South Africa, various other systems now incorporate a weaker form of judicial review. The United Kingdom does as well. It has its own variety of judicial review. Now, what's distinctive about this particular kind of judicial review is that court decisions on the constitutionality of legislation are not necessarily final. So, just to give you one example, in Canada, we have in our constitution a section that includes what is referred to as the notwithstanding clause. Now, what this section says is this, that Parliament is entitled to declare a piece of legislation legally valid, notwithstanding its conflict with a charter right, with a constitutional right found in our Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. In other words, even if the Supreme Court says this legislation violates the Constitution, in some instances the Parliament can respond by saying, well, notwithstanding that violation, this is going to stand as valid law. So this is a weaker form of review. It's still a review. It still has some power, and Parliament is reluctant, very reluctant, to take the step of invoking the notwithstanding clause. But nevertheless, it's there, and that makes the system unlike the American system, where there is no recourse to for Parliament. The United Kingdom has a different kind of weaker form judicial review under the UK Human Rights Act, which recognizes as constitutionally valid the European Convention on Human Rights. And the form of review that's licensed in the United Kingdom is of the following form. The judges can issue what is called a declaration of incompatibility. So in other words, what they can do is issue a declaration, an official declaration. It's a legal judgment that an act of Parliament violates the European Convention, is therefore invalid law. Because the system now recognizes the Convention of Human Rights as a binding constitutional document. However, the effect of the judicial of the declaration of incompatibility is not to invalidate the law. In other words, the law still operates. It's an advisory opinion, if you like, that the judges are declaring an incompatibility, but there's no practical effect, legally speaking, as there is, say, in the United States, whereas if the Supreme Court rules that there's an incompatibility, that means that the law is no longer valid. It's struck off the books. In Britain, it's still on the books, despite the declaration by the Supreme Court. It turns out that in practice, what Parliament does whenever there's a declaration of incompatibility is modify the legislation to render it compatible. So in effect, there is a parliamentary response, even though it's not legally mandated. But it's become the practice that Parliament does respond in this way. So in effect, you've got something that's very similar to the kind of thing that's possible in Canada, for example, where Parliament can actually invoke the Section 33 override.
We know that you have a really busy schedule, so I have just two questions in this interview.
Okay.
The first one is, in the Living Tree book, you have a kind of confrontation with Jeremy Waldron.
Yes.
So it's interesting to me to know what are your points of agreement and disagreement with Jeremy Waldron, because he's a major thinker around mm-hmm. right now. And the other one, in the introduction of your book of Inclusive Legal Positivism, you say that you don't want to talk about morals. You don't want to get into the subject of morals.
Oh, did I really say that?
And so the question is, is there any book ahead where you talk about that, or you still rather not talk about morality?
Well, I do talk about morality a lot. I talk about morality a little bit in the second book, in the Living Tree book, because I elaborate on this much further in some further publications where I distinguish different types of morality. I talk about Platonic morality, which is the kind of morality most people have in mind, you know, the moral truth. And then I distinguish that from what I call the community's constitutional morality, and then I talk about, you know, person's own morality and the morality of an institution and so on. So I do talk about I do say a lot of things about morality, but I don't offer my own moral theory about things. I tend not to do that because I don't see myself primarily as a moral philosopher. I'm a legal philosopher. Now, as far as Waldron, I have the utmost respect for Waldron's work. I think he's one of the best legal and moral and political philosophers today, and it's a testament to the respect that I hold for his work that I essentially dedicated the book to answering his objections. I am pretty much fundamentally at odds with him about the justification of judicial review, and about what's required for democracy, So to that extent, there's not a lot of agreement there. But I think there's mutual respect.
Well, Dr. Balushev, it has been a pleasure to talk with you.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.